Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our guest today is Linda Greenhouse, who has covered the Supreme Court for the New York Times for 30 years and has just joined the faculty of the Yale Law School. Linda, welcome to Berkeley.
Thanks for having me.
Where were you born and raised?
I was born in New York City. My parents moved out of New York City back to my father's hometown in New Haven, Connecticut, when I was a baby, so I grew up outside of New Haven.
And what was the conversation like around the dinner table? Was there a discussion of the law, or is this something that just came to you later, an interest?
No, there wasn't discussion of law. My father was a doctor. He and my mother were interested in public affairs, so we talked about, you know, current events, not like the Kennedys, not, you know, I don't want to exaggerate, but no, not law per se.
And looking back, how do you think your parents shaped your thinking about the world?
Well, I think they had a basically progressive outlook on the world. They weren't politically engaged, but they were Democrats. You know, I think I grew up with that kind of basic orientation that FDR was a great president. Mm-hmm. I guess my first political consciousness was in the JFK era. When Kennedy became president, I was in junior high school, and I was very taken with him and his whole, you know, what he represented. And so that was kind of my own political awakening.
Was it natural that you would fall into being a Supreme Court reporter? I'm just looking at this early period. We'll talk about your education.
I think somebody outside looking at a career path like mine would say, oh, she spent 30 years covering the Supreme Court for the New York Times. This must have been according to some grand design. But I think like a lot of careers, it really was quite random. What I wanted to be was a journalist. Mm. And I think in part because of my fascination with the young John Kennedy and so on, I read The Making of the President in 1960, the great Theodore White book, which was really the first book ever to get behind the scenes of a modern political campaign. And what I took away from it at the age of 16 or 15 was, you know, people got paid for flying around the country writing articles about my hero. And, you know, maybe this was a job that one could aspire to. So what I wanted to be was a journalist, and what I wanted to be was a political journalist, and that's what I started out being, actually.
Mm-hmm. And before we get to that choice, where were you educated?
Went to public school in Hamden, Connecticut, and then I went to Radcliffe College, which is now Harvard. So Harvard, I would say.
Yes. And what did you major in?
I majored in American government.
Uh-huh. So you had the politics bug plus the journalism bug.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I, you know, wasn't sort of out there on the front lines of anything. I mean, I wasn't a political activist, you might say, like a number of my friends were in the late 1960s, but I was very interested as a subject.
And what about your skills as a writer, which are quite good? Did that just come naturally through your education at Radcliffe?
I think so.
Harvard?
Well, in high school, I had teachers who really prized writing, and we got a lot of writing in school, and I always was working on the school paper, and I was editor of the high school newspaper, and always did a lot of writing on the side, and was an editor of the Harvard Crimson, Harvard Daily Paper. I would say, I mean, I never took a course in a formal way on sort of writing or on journalism, for that matter, but it sort of came.
Mm-hmm. And did you go right into journalism after your graduation, and what did you cover?
Yes, I was one of the few people that I knew that didn't go to graduate school. I went out in the...
Lucky you.
Lucky me. I went out in the workplace, and I was very fortunate to get hired as an intern by James Reston, who was then one of the most famous newspaper columnists in the country. James Reston of the New York Times had his own kind of clerkship program that he actually had modeled after a Supreme Court clerkship, where he would take a kid every year out of college from a college newspaper background, and they would get to work with him doing research for him, doing whatever, mm-hmm. learning the business at his side for 1 year, and then typically get a chance to have a staff tryout at the New York Times. And so that's what happened to me.
Mm-hmm. And what do you think you learned from him? Because he was a unique figure in American journalism, and some might say that we don't see as many columnists like that these days.
Oh, he was a unique figure in many ways. And in fact, my year's experience with him was unusual among the 20 or 30 young people who had the chance mm-hmm. that I had, because the year that I worked for him, actually, we were not in Washington, which was his home base. There was some kind of internal political crisis at the New York Times. Mm-hmm. I don't even know exactly what it was, but he became, just at the time that I was graduating to go to work for him, he became executive editor of the New York Times.
I see.
For that 1 year. So his base of operations moved to New York, and he kept writing his column, and I kept doing research and handling column-related chores for him. But he was also running the newspaper. Mm-hmm. So he had a staff of grown-ups that were working for him. And, you know, I didn't have anything to do with that side of it. So, you know, but what I got was a kind of a ringside seat at the internal workings of the newspaper. So I certainly learned a lot.
And Reston, as I think back, was somebody who was kind of at the center of the center which existed at that time in American politics.
Yes.
Did you experience any of that in the sense of getting the impression of the way American politics worked, national politics, the New York Times, in what must have been a different era?
Well, it was the Vietnam era. Mm-hmm. We're talking,
so it was coming unraveling a bit.
That's right. We're talking 1968, 1969, it was the election of Richard Nixon.
Mm-hmm. Okay,
cities were burning. Mm-hmm. Washington was filled with demonstrations. It was a very...
It was after the period I was describing.
Very tumultuous time, and it was disturbing to him because he was a man of the establishment, you might say, and things weren't supposed to work the way they worked. Although, when I say establishment, I mean he was no fan of Richard Nixon. And in fact, that was my first election, 1968. In those days, you had to be 21 in order to vote. And I remember I was very dismayed about the course of politics. And, you know, Hubert Humphrey didn't seem to me to embody the kind of change, you might say, in today's parlance that I wanted. And I said, oh, I don't know, maybe I'll just vote for Nixon. And I remember he growled at me and he said, Greenhouse, you're voting for Humphrey. Yes, sir.
Yeah.
So, you know, he was a person of strong views. But, you know, what I got to witness at his side was he worked really hard. Mm-hmm. And he was always on the phone. He was always talking to people. He wasn't one of these pundits that would sort of sit in an ivory tower and talk to himself.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember one thing that he told me. He didn't give me a whole lot of advice. He was very busy running the newspaper. But he did make an observation that really stuck with me, which is that don't be afraid to ask questions while you're interviewing or reporting, or you're at the scene of an event, because if you're too shy or feel too inhibited to ask the question then, and you sit down to write the story, mm-hmm. that's when you really need to know the answer, and then it's too late. Mm-hmm. So always get your questions out there, and always try to learn more than 100% of what you're going to have to disgorge in your mm-hmm. writing. If you're just at that 100% and you have no reserve, you're on pretty thin ice. And of course, if you know less than 100% of what you need to know, you're really in trouble. So I carried that with me into my later career, and always did try to go the extra mile and learn more than I knew I was going to be pressed to know in the context of the daily journalism.
Mm-hmm. Your first assignment was what, once you left being at Reston's side?
I was a reporter on general assignment on the Metro staff at the Times for oh, maybe about 6 months, and then they sent me to one of the suburban bureaus, Westchester County, a suburban county just north of New York City, and I stayed there for almost 4 years.
And then did you go to Albany after that?
Then I had a little stint on what they call night rewrite, so I would come in every day late in the afternoon and just do whatever. You know, don't forget, that was, those were the days when there was actually a news cycle. And, you know, the paper came out in the morning, and that's when people got their news. It's not, wasn't the 24/7 news cycle that we have today. So I covered some very trivial things. I covered some very major things. I remember one of the major things was the coup in Chile, the murder of Salvador Allende. And we didn't have an obit of Allende in the files because there was no anticipation that he was soon to die. And so I remember having to cobble up that right on deadline and recount the whole history, the modern political history of Chile, using whatever resources we had immediately at hand. And I'm not talking about Google or the internet. I'm talking about, you know, clip files with hard copies. So it was very exciting, and I learned a lot. I really liked it, actually. It was fabulous training. So I did that for maybe about three quarters of a year, and then got the chance to go to the Albany Bureau, cover the state legislature.
And what was it like covering state politics? I mean, what did you learn from that experience? Because just thinking about it, it must have been very different from covering the Supreme Court.
Oh, well, I mean, any young reporter should try to work covering a state capitol, because just on the simplest level, it's fantastic, good fun. I mean, it's a three-ring circus, no matter what the capital is, if it's Sacramento, if it's Austin, and Albany certainly was that. So that was just, you know, pure fun. But on the substance, those were the years in the mid to late 1970s, the years of the New York City fiscal crisis, which folks here may not remember, but the fiscal,
we have our own.
You have your own, and now the country has its own, since we're talking in September of 2008. But back in the 1970s, New York City was technically bankrupt, and this was an amazing evolution, and the question was what to do about it, and it had taken years for that crisis to mount up, and it took years for it to be resolved, and I was there on the resolution side of it. So it was... it was really fascinating that New York had a really outstanding governor, Hugh Carey, the first Democratic governor in New York in, I think, 16 years, right after the Rockefeller era ended. And he didn't know anything about municipal finance, neither did anybody. But they knew they had to learn it really quick. And so they called on some of the smartest people on Wall Street. Felix Rowatin is a name people might recognize, was just a young investment banker. He was brought in, and everybody put their shoulder to the wheel and worked out a way of getting through this crisis. And I was really on the front lines covering it on a daily basis. So I learned the substance of municipal finance. I learned about politics. I was exposed to some fascinating personalities, and it was just a great experience.
Would it be fair to say that covering the Supreme Court is more like an academic exercise than covering state politics, in the sense that you're looking at decisions, cases out there from an office?
Well, I mean, it certainly doesn't have the face-to-face quality that covering a political institution has. But I think what my Albany experience gave me was a bit of a sense of a court, the Supreme Court, as an institution that's inherently a part of our political process. And so when you say academic, I mean, it might have a sort of an academic feel that you're sitting and reading most of the time instead of kind of, you know, mixing it up with the newsmakers. But I think what I tried to bring to my reporting on the court was a sense of context, and a lot of times it's political context, because Supreme Court cases don't just drop out of the sky. They come out of something. They come out of some conflict in society that leads to litigation, that leads to lower court decisions, that leads directly to the Supreme Court. And I try to maintain a sense of that and give my readers a feel for that.
Right. So I guess what I was making was a distinction of how you gather the information versus, you know, the actual write-up and so on. So in Supreme Court work, you're following the cases, obviously, that are out there in the country that are coming before the court. But are you doing a lot of interviewing?
Not doing a lot of interviewing, but I'm following than the cases. I'm following the kind of political landscape to understand the context in which these cases are occurring.
Yes. And you've written in some of both in the Blackmun book and in your articles about the dynamics within the court, which I found interesting. In the Blackmun book, you wrote about the court's processes. You said there was a fluidity with which coalitions formed and shifted and formed again depending on the issue. It was extremely foolish ever to write off a likely opponent or to take a potential ally for granted. With so many cases under consideration at once, a colleague might at any given moment be both opponent and ally. So this was a dynamic that you came to see over the course of your term. Now, talk a little about that.
Well, I think that was, I was writing about a period in the 1970s and 80s, but it's still true today. Yeah. I mean, in the kind of small group dynamic of nine people, you know, you can't take anybody for granted. And what happens at the court, you know, somebody gets assigned to take a try at crafting a majority opinion. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's just taking a crack at it. And nobody can speak for the court unless four other people sign their name on what you're circulating. So I think, you know, for instance, a lot of people ask me, well, after Bush against Gore, the 2000 election case, you know, which was so hard fought and so bitterly dissented from by the four dissenters, you know, how could they get back together? How could the court function? And, you know, I always answer, they knew they had to get back together. Mm-hmm. Because it's not like Congress where, you know, you can be part of a caucus that goes off and sulks in the cloakroom until things start breaking your way. You don't have that luxury at the Supreme Court. You've got to get on to the next case, you know, pronto. And you've got to be able to count to five if you're going to get anything done. So I think that is a basic dynamic that keeps the court going, even in a period where there are pretty sharp disagreements and the court is quite polarized on a lot of important things.
And you have friendships that cross, you know, intellectual barriers, so to speak. I believe Ginsburg is a friend of Scalia, and in the case of Blackmun, he had been close to Berger, but over the course of years, they went different ways.
Yeah, I mean, I think friendship or lack of friendship can be sort of, you know, too easily exaggerated. I mean, I think, you know, they all try to be collegial. They're all grown-ups. Mm-hmm. But I don't think where the rubber meets the road in terms of how you're going to vote in a case, it's not like a political branch where there would be vote trading or, you know, you're a good guy, I'll support your project today and on the expectation that you'll support my pet project tomorrow. It's not like that. You just vote how you think the case should come out.
Mm-hmm. Let me show your Blackmun book. We'll get into it. Becoming Justice Blackmun, it's an intellectual biography, a biography, and the story of his life on the court and actually his life even before that. And when from this book, I got the sense that law clerks can be very important. I mean, the justice is still in charge, but often they are a kind of a source of stretching the intellectual boundaries of what's in the judge's mind, although they don't necessarily, I'm not saying they decide the decision, but they help stretch the justice's mind. Is that fair?
Well, I think that was probably true in Blackman's case. Yeah. I'm not sure it's true in every case. It's a very intimate relationship, the justice and the law clerks. Each justice has four law clerks, and they serve for a year. And they are the best and the brightest of the recent law school graduates. They've all been law review editors, and they've all clerked on some other court before they come to the Supreme Court. So the justices who use them well, I think, use them as a source of intellectual energy and refreshment. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, you're up in your ivory tower as a Supreme Court justice, and you're kind of, you know, not necessarily in the mix of kind of the current ferment over the Constitution or whatever. So the reason they use the system, and not every court does. I mean, there are courts that have, not the federal courts, but there are, you know, state courts or whatever, who have a cadre of professional clerk research staff, and they don't turn over every year, and that's another model. But the reason that the federal courts use this clerkship model is there's an affirmative benefit from it to the judges.
Do you think that the way the court is perceived by society has changed a lot in the course of your career? Has the court become politicized at a new level, or does this just periodically happen in American history, as was the case in the New Deal?
Well, I mean, your question seems to assume that I think the court is politicized.
No, I'm asking. I'm just asking. In other words, as an observer, I'm not a legal scholar, looking from afar. It seems to that we've gone through a recent period of high politicization, and I guess I should define what I mean by that. I mean the way the Supreme Court becomes an object of political concern in the greater society. I'm not talking about necessarily the politicization among the members of the court, which would be a different question.
Well, I started covering the court sort of at the end of the long shadow of the Warren Court. And, you know, Richard Nixon came to national political prominence and ran for president in 1968, running against the Supreme Court. So, I mean, the Supreme Court is a very handy target for politicians, and that is certainly nothing new. In fact, I think right now that the political discourse about the court is at a lower level, is almost, you know, beneath the radar. I keep waiting for the presidential candidates this year to have a good, rip-roaring discussion about the Supreme Court. That has not yet occurred, and it never occurred in the Clinton years, although I kept waiting for it then, too. So, you know, I think the court can serve political purposes when a national politician thinks it's in their interest to make it. But that isn't necessarily anything that's inherent in the court itself at one period or another.
You write, let me give you another quote about the Supreme Court from your book. Maybe this was from the book, I'm not sure. In fact, it is most often the Supreme Court that is the follower. You're talking about its relationship to society. It ratifies or consolidates change rather than propelling it, although in the midst of heated debate over a major case, it can appear otherwise. You go on to say, I'm simply offering my empirical observation that the court lives in constant dialogue with other institutions, formal and informal, and then when it strays too far outside the existing political or social consensus, the result is palpable tension both inside and outside the court. I believe this actually appeared in the New York Times.
That was in a kind of a retrospective piece that appeared in July.
Comment on that. Do you want to say anything more than that, because it's obviously the case that in particular cases, Roe v. Wade, which you discuss because in the Blackmun book, because he of course wrote the opinion, that was a case where the court may have gone too far, if we not in the sense of women's rights, but in the sense of the way society reacted.
Well, or I would say more current about it. I mean, on my watch at the court, certainly affirmative action was was a hot topic. And the court wrestled with it the Bakke case, 1978, was one of the first major cases that I covered, and you know, ended up with a 4-4-1. The one in those days was the swing voter on the court in those days, Justice Powell, and that continues to be something that the court hasn't come to a real consensus. The most recent affirmative action case, the cases from the University of Michigan from about 5 years ago, was sort of the last word and bought the court and bought society some time. But that's been a real pressure point. And so when I say the court is most comfortable following the existing consensus, and when it feels that it's getting out in front, there's a kind of an institutional tension. I think what I had in mind was the affirmative action line of cases. On abortion, I mean, what's so interesting when you get back in the actual papers that led to that informed the court's consideration of Roe against Wade in 1971, 72, 73, January 73, the opinion finally comes out, is the court was fairly clueless about how that opinion was going to fly. The court didn't really feel itself out in front. In fact, I think the seven justices who signed the majority opinion felt that they were ratifying what had come to be at least the elite consensus in the country. And they were right. I mean, there was Gallup polls that back this up, that people had come to think that the regime of criminal abortion laws and throwing doctors in jail for performing abortions had actually created a public health crisis, because women were having abortions anyway, as they always were and always would, but they weren't safe. And so it was an effort to kind of just bring that whole area into the 20th century.
You talk a great deal about that case in the Blackmun book, because, of course, he wrote the opinion. And let's talk a little about that, because it actually conveys a sense of the way personality comes to play, the background of a particular judge, the fortuna of getting chosen to write the opinion, and so on. And Blackmun had an interesting background, because he was appointed by President Nixon after President Nixon had failed in getting two appointments, Haynesworth and Carswell, through the Senate. And then he turned to Blackmun, who was a lifelong friend of Justice Berger.
Chief Justice Warren Berger, right. They had grown up together in St. Paul, Minnesota.
So the expectation would be that Blackmun would tilt toward the conservative side, not based on his legal background, but just the politics.
Well, based on his legal background, too. When the Nixon administration was considering him, a young lawyer in the Justice Department named William Rehnquist was given the assignment of checking out Harry Blackmun's record on the Eighth Circuit, the Federal Court of Appeals that is based in St. Louis, to make sure he was conservative enough, and he was. I mean, there was very little in his record as an appeals court judge that would indicate that he was going to end up 24 years later as the most liberal member of the Supreme Court. And when he started out on the court, he was quite conservative. I mean, the first big constitutional controversy that he confronted in his time at the Supreme Court, it was not abortion, it was the death penalty. And in 1972, when the court in the Furman case held unconstitutional every death penalty statute in the country, Blackmun dissented. And a couple years later, in the Pentagon Papers case, when the court held that the government did not have the right to block the publication of the Pentagon Papers by the New York Times and the Washington Post, Blackmun dissented. So he was a quite conservative justice when he started out.
There was some fascinating items in his background which really stand out in your wonderful judicial biography, I guess you would say, and that is that for 10 years after graduating from the Harvard Law School, he was chief counsel for the Mayo Clinic, which kind of exposed him to the world of medicine and legal problems that arise thereof.
Well, he loved medicine, and he had considered going to medical school. Mm-hmm. And the only reason, actually, he chose law school over medical school was it was cheaper and it had fewer requirements to get in. So he was really drawn to medicine. He practiced with a big law firm in Minneapolis that had, as a client, the Mayo Clinic. Mm-hmm. And he actually did a lot of tax work for the Mayo Clinic. And so the Mayo Clinic asked him, was setting up an in-house position as general counsel, and they offered him the job. And he decided to leave private practice and go work full-time at Mayo. And, his job wasn't medical, although sort of malpractice and medical issues came up. But he would go on the grand rounds with the Mayo doctors, mm. As they went around, with the patients. And he loved it and found it very fascinating and fulfilling.
Mm-hmm. And what is fascinating in this story as it unfolds is then when the case was decided, the justices, or at least Blackmun, was focused on the liability of doctors who performed abortions. That there was a great concern that the whole malpractice issue and I guess even criminal statutes that some states had against abortion was a real threat to the practice of medicine. And then in addition, if the court didn't decide, then judges were lacking guidance on how to respond to such cases. The bottom line being that you're suggesting that the concern about women and their situation was kind of a third-order priority in making that decision. Is that a fair reading of what you're writing?
Well, yeah, and I think it's the only way to read, what actually occurred. I mean, this isn't just my thought about it. There's a lot of anachronistic thinking about Roe against Wade. Roe against Wade preceded the modern women's movement. Mm-hmm. And at the time it made its way to the Supreme Court in the beginning of the 1970s, the court didn't have kind of sex discrimination or women's rights in mind, really didn't. And Roe presents, and if people read it, and of course most people are happy to talk about it without ever having read it, but if people actually sit down and read it, they will find in it a doctor's bill of rights, not a women's bill of rights. And of course, doctors were the ones who were being criminally prosecuted. Women weren't being prosecuted for having abortions. The crime was to perform an abortion. So it was doctors who were on the line. And there had been a number of cases. There had been a German measles epidemic, and doctors wanted to perform for their patients what were then known as therapeutic abortions, because these fetuses would be predictably badly damaged by the German measles. There had been the thalidomide episode where a woman famously, left the country and went to Scandinavia to have an abortion. And so, change was in the wind. And the leading medical organizations like the American Medical Association, the American Public Health Association, and so on, that had for decades had a position against legalizing abortion, had very recently changed their position. And so the court's consideration of this issue was reflecting those trends and those observations, and what they had in mind was, we've got a public health issue, and we're treating it as, resolving a public health problem.
And so what you're saying is, in a way, that their focus was such that they didn't realize that they were moving ahead of society in the way that ultimately became the case in terms of the almost immediate reaction. And you tell the story that Blackmun has a speaking engagement after he delivers the majority opinion, and there were pickets, and he opposing the decision, and he was taken aback because he didn't understand the politics yet.
Right. Well, when you say the court was moving ahead of society, I don't think so. I think the court was pretty much where society was. What happened was it became a wedge issue in the hands of a political movement, mm-hmm. that was happy to hitch its wagon to that particular star. And that's what happened, and it got away from the court. Mm-hmm. But at the time the court ruled, there was, you know, polling, and it was clear that there was a public consensus that the question of abortion was between a woman and her doctor and not for the state.
And in the decision, there was an opening for the notion that at some point a state interest came into play when you considered the whole term of the pregnancy. But the decision itself was based on the penumbra of privacy that they found in the Ninth Amendment.
Well, yeah, I mean, in part, in the 14th Amendment and so on. But, yeah, I mean, you're talking about the trimester system where the court said, and, you know, lots of people have criticized the kind of the trimester aspect of Roe. But when you think about it, you know, it's not a foolish concept to say that it's a balancing of the state's interest and the woman's interest, and once a fetus is viable in the third trimester, the state's interest in the life-preserving aspect becomes a good deal stronger than at the very beginning. I mean, we can debate the kind of philosophy of this, but certainly what the court had in mind was that in the first trimester, when abortion is notably safer than carrying a child to term, the state really has no interest in preventing abortion, and its only interest is in making sure that it's done under, you know, safe, medically appropriate conditions. In the second trimester, the state's interest grows a bit because abortion becomes more dangerous medically, and finally, in the last trimester, the state's interest is pretty strong, but still cannot trump the interests of the woman in preserving her own life and health. And that, you know, that's still our law today.
Mm-hmm. And after the decision, the political movement, the anti-abortion political movement, created a political context where various states began taking, I think you call it, guerrilla action against the opinion by looking at the various ways in which the abortion could be obstructed or prevented. Talk a little about that, because it's a classic case where the Supreme Court reaches a decision. You're saying it really reflected the views of society, but then the turbulence came, as you say, when a political movement emerged to take advantage of this.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's still going on today. Yeah. It's going on this very day. So what you had were states. I mean, Missouri was a major one, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Illinois, where they couldn't prohibit abortion, but they could create obstacles and make women and their doctors jump through a set of hoops. And so cases came up about, well, do you need your husband's consent? The court said, no, you can't require the husband's consent. Well, how about the husband's notice? The husband has to be on notice. No, you can't require that either. Well, doctors have to read women a certain script to make them think again or think harder or go home or whatever. And initially the court said, no, you can't do that. Then the court, a more conservative court, said, yes, you can do that to some extent. There's a case making its way to the court right now from the Eighth Circuit from South Dakota, where doctors are required to read a truly offensive script before going ahead with the abortion. And it's being challenged as an infringement on the First Amendment rights of doctors, compelled government speech. So these things are still going on, and they have generated, you know, dozens of cases, whether this obstacle or that obstacle presented, in the court's analysis, a, quote, undue burden on the woman's right to abortion.
Mm-hmm. Are you surprised by the litmus test that abortion has become in the politics of appointments to the Supreme Court? Are there other cases of a narrow focus like this in the history of the court?
Well, I think there are, in the sense that You certainly couldn't nominate somebody to the Supreme Court that, for instance, thought Brown against Board of Education was a bad decision. Mm-hmm. And there was a time when, you know, that was, people had to be pretty clear about that. I think what's different about abortion is that society, or at least kind of civilized society, pretty quickly settled on Brown against Board as a correct decision. But yet there's obviously, as we know, still a number of people that think Roe against Wade was the opposite of a correct decision. So it's still, it remains a battleground. So, you know, I guess it's not surprising. What I think is
bizarre.
Well, kind of self-defeating.
Yeah.
For the Republican Party to have this as a one-dimensional litmus test it disables them from considering a lot of highly qualified conservative lawyers and judges who just aren't necessarily, you know, anti-abortion movement activists. I mean, that's what brought us Harriet Myers. Mm-hmm. You know, in 2005, when President Bush felt correctly, I think, that after Sandra O'Connor's announcement that she was going to retire, it was important to have another woman on the court. But there were very few women who could pass the anti-abortion litmus test, even though there were a number of superbly qualified Republican female judges and lawyers in the country. They were passed over immediately. Mm-hmm. And the administration basically ran out of potential nominees. So I think that's self-defeating for them, but I'm not one of them, so, you know.
In your book on Blackmun, you record, through a careful examination of his papers, his intellectual growth on certain issues, how he came to see the broader context of problems. And an example here would be the whole question of women's rights, which he didn't perceive, even though he discussed the decision beforehand with his three daughters and his wife, but he didn't sort of understand the broader context of women's rights. But he grew, and that changed. Do you think that his story tells us a lot about the way many justices on the Supreme Court grow on the court? Not all, but many.
Well, that's a good question. Of course, these are loaded words, because you and I can say grow with kind of approval. Now, on the other side, you know, that's viewed as a kind of a liberal, mm-hmm. you know, kind of throwaway. But it is true that once somebody gets to the Supreme Court, no matter where they come from, they've got to take a broader look at things, and things look different up there. Now, there's been a fair amount of recent social science research on this, on justices who changed from their starting ideology. And what the current research has shown, and Blackmun is a paradigm case, is that justices who come from outside of Washington, beyond the Beltway, without prior experience working for the executive branch, are the most likely to change, to move to the left, to define our terms. And those who come from inside Washington or have prior federal government experience are least likely to change. And, you know, when you think about it, it makes sense. Mm-hmm. Because a move to Washington in midlife, Blackmun was 60 or 61 when he came on the court, didn't have any Washington experience. You know, it's very disruptive and mind-bending and mind-opening. So it's not surprising that this happens, and it's happened to a lot more people than just Harry Blackmun.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that it's better? Let me get your evaluation of the category of appointees to the court. Do you think? How do you evaluate putting lawyers who also have been in politics at the state level, or even at the national level, as opposed to coming to the court from a circuit court?
Well, personally, I think it would be a very good thing to sort of mix it up a little and have some politicians on the court. The court we have now every single justice had as their immediate past job service on a federal court of appeals. That's unique in the country's history. Mm. That hadn't happened before. The Warren Court, I believe I'm right in saying, not only was it headed by Earl Warren, who had never been a judge of any kind, mm-hmm. three-time governor of California, but I think there was nobody on the Warren Court who had been a federal judge. Mm-hmm. Justice Brennan had been a state judge in New Jersey. Mm-hmm. But no one had been a federal judge. And so, you know, that court had a sort of a grounding in the mm-hmm. political life of the country that came from that background. Mm-hmm. Or people look at Justice O'Connor, who had been a state court judge in Arizona, but had also been majority leader of the Arizona State Senate and had run for election. And she was really a kind of a political animal. And she brought a sort of a pragmatic, grounded sense of what the country needed to her 20-plus years mm-hmm. on the court that I think was very salutary. So I would hope that the next president, whoever wins the election, would look outside the box and find somebody with a different background.
You're on campus as the Jefferson lecturer, and I know you're going to be talking about the mystery of Guantanamo and that set of decisions. What is one gets the sense as I read, I've read about these cases, I've read your articles, and one gets the sense that the Guantanamo decisions, let's call not just the last decision, it's really about the court drawing a line and trying to judiciously inform the executive that it didn't buy into where it was drawing the line in the sand. Is that a fair assessment? And the decision seemed to almost be saying, you didn't listen to our last decision. Is that a correct reading?
Yes, I think that's an excellent, yeah. you know, 25-word or less yeah. summary of my kind of long, yeah. complicated lecture, which I call The Mystery of Guantanamo Bay. And the mystery is, how can it be that the Bush administration has lost case after case after case in the U.S. Supreme Court, but yet has never been ordered by any judge or any person or body in position of authority to release against its will a single Guantanamo detainee? Mm-hmm. This is a mystery. How can this be? Mm-hmm. And so it really is a story of the administration pushing and pushing and pushing, the court drawing first a gentle line and then a less gentle line, and then last June, 2 months ago in the Boumediene decision, granting constitutional rights to habeas corpus to the detainees, you know, a firmer line. And it's like, what part of the rule of law don't you understand? It's been a kind of a one-way dialogue and very unusual in mm-hmm. our history and very fascinating.
Is it because of the two elements come to mind? I'm going to go to your lecture, so I'll know the answer later. But is it about, one, the fragility of the coalition on the court, and also the uniqueness of this experience that we all went through at 9/11, namely that we were attacked on our homeland by an organization that isn't the state? Is that
involved? Well, those are elements of yeah. the whole picture. Yeah. That's not what I focus on. What I'm focusing on really is the separation of powers element to the way this is played out. And, you know, the court, as we said earlier, I mean, the court is basically a modest and quite conservative institution. So when the first cases reach the court rules quite modestly, not making a sweeping constitutional pronouncement. They just decide what they have to decide. And what they basically decide in the first round in 2004 is, you know, you bet wrong when you decided to put the detainees at Guantanamo. You bet that this would be outside the jurisdiction of the federal courts. And, you know, it's functionally the United States. We exercise complete power and control there. It is within the statutory jurisdiction of the federal courts to entertain petitions for habeas corpus. That's all the court said. One might think that was enough. But the administration basically, you know, ignored that and kept right on going. And so that set in motion a dynamic where the court, with increasing dismay, alarm, and I think almost a sense of disbelief, kept, you know, learning that its message was just not being received. And so you know, finally the decision that came down in June of this year, the Boumediene case, you know, do we have to hit you with a 2x4? We mean habeas corpus. Mm-hmm. So it's just been a fascinating trajectory.
Mm-hmm. And to what extent does the court, or do we know yet, have a very different view of the president's power vis-a-vis treaties, international treaties? Because on the one hand, in these Guantanamo cases, it's saying that Article 3 applies from the Geneva Conventions. But on the other hand, in this recent Mexican case, I don't know if we can mix these different things where they allowed the state of Texas to do what its legal processes had said and said, you know, put aside the treaties that were involved.
Well, yeah. I mean, I don't think those are...
They're not related.
They're okay. Not really related. Yeah. I mean, the case you're talking about is the Medellin case. where the Mexican death row inmate had not gotten sort of read the rights that are required under the treaty that we signed called the Vienna Convention. What the court held there is that the Vienna Convention governs relationships between the signatory, among the signatory states, the countries, and is not self-executing. It can't be invoked by an individual. Mm-hmm. So that was a kind of a technical reading of treaty, a different kind of international law thing.
Okay, but what about the application of the Geneva Conventions? I mean, is this it's probably a court that wants to find the narrowest grounds to
Yeah, I mean, the court basically is deferential and wants the political branches to figure this out. And so what the court said in the middle of these three cases, the Hamdan case in 2006, which was the case about the legitimacy of the military commissions that the president had set up to conduct the criminal trials of the detainees, is you've got to set this up within the framework of the Geneva Conventions, and you've got to get congressional input. It can't be just a unilateral executive decision. And so that then went back to Congress, and Congress did, in the Military Commissions Act of 2006, reconfigure the military commissions. Now, what they also did was strip the federal courts of jurisdiction to hear habeas corpus petitions, and that's what led to the next decision. But the court took account of the Geneva Conventions in that case.
As you leave the Times, what? And we're, this program is aired nationally. What would you like the message to an audience of not necessarily some lawyers in the audience, but not the legal community? What is the lesson you would like to leave them with about what you've learned about the Supreme Court? Is there a simple way of putting how we should understand the court's role in the evolution of our democracy? Big question.
Well, what I ended up that retrospective piece that you referred to earlier was with the sort of ironic observation that, you know, we get the court we deserve. Mm-hmm. And people say to me, what do you mean by that? And I mean, you know, the court requires us to do the work of paying attention to what it does and you know, desiring it to reflect the best that our system has to display. And I think what I've come away with is that, I mean, I respect the court as an institution, maybe more than a mere journalist should, but I do expect, you know, I hope for the best from them. And I think that it takes work to follow what the court does. It requires a lot of the public to really stick with it. I think good journalism about the court can enable the public to do that. And to the extent that a lot of newspapers and news organizations are cutting back on Supreme Court coverage, I think that's a disturbing trend. But I would say to people, you know, stick with it because it's really important, and it's important that it be understood and that the court and the presidents who make the appointments that make up the court be held to account.
I wanted to read you one quote from your farewell article because you've actually watched a lot of history during this period that you've been covering the court. And you're talking about here about Sandra Day O'Connor and Ruth Ginsburg. And I found this amusing, but I want you to just, years later, my daughter bluntly reminded me that today's young women have the luxury of taking for granted the pioneering accomplishments of Sandra Day O'Connor or Ruth Bader Ginsburg. When I observed that I was out of college before I ever met a woman who was a lawyer, your teenage daughter regarded me with compassion. Face it, Mom, you've led a sheltered life. Does that convey the changes that you've watched as you've watched this important institution?
Well, in part, and I guess what, you know, what's kind of amusing about that is, you know, I don't think I have led a sheltered life. I've had a ringside seat in history. So, you know, I feel very lucky to have not had a sheltered life.
And one final question is, what should we be watching for as we go through the presidential election? Well, first, the court, as you said, is not a topic of discussion. But as an informed observer, what would you be concerned about and what would you hope would happen?
There's a very good book out now that I've recommended to people. It's called The Next Justice. It's by Christopher Eisgruber, who's the provost of Princeton. He's a Supreme Court scholar and former Supreme Court law clerk. And his point in this book, it's a book that looks at the Supreme Court confirmation process, but he makes an obvious but very infrequently made point, which is that before we get into a debate about what kind of justice we'd like on the Supreme Court when the next vacancy occurs, we need to come to some common understanding about what is the judicial function. What do Supreme Court justices do? What do we expect of the court? So I would like to see that kind of conversation and not just the sound bites about, you know, I want justices who follow the law and not make the law. You know, what does this mean? It's completely meaningless. But really, you know, understand what we ask of the court and what the court does, and to have a, you know, the kind of civics education that I think is kind of missing in our public discourse.
On that note, Linda, thank you very much for coming to Berkeley to be the Jefferson Lecturer, and thank you for being on our program.
And thank you for having me.
Thank you. And thank you very much for joining us for this conversation with history.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.